I could do to keep from crying.
Well, you know who had his ashes spread at home plate?
The dude that did the Go Cubs Go song. Yeah, wasn't his name Goodman?
Yeah, Steve Goodman.
You know what else he wrote?
He wrote the perfect country and western song, and then he sent it to either Waylon Jennings or one of those guys.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
They read it, and they said, this is almost perfect, but you didn't mention anything about mama or prison.
Because he hadn't said anything at all about mama.
Or train.
Or train.
Or pickup trucks.
Or trucks.
So then Goodwin allegedly wrote the next verse, which was, it was raining the day my mama got out of prison.
The day my mom got out of prison. And I went to pick her up in the rain. But before I could get to the station in the pickup, she got run over by a damned old train. And I'll hang around as long as you will let me. And I never mind it standing in the rain. Oh, you don't have to call.
System is on the air.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Go. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Jimmy on the board. S&P futures up 14. NASDAQ futures up 25. Trying to make it an update today. We had a couple down days. An update yesterday. We're trying to make it two in a row to the upside. Do we have Professor Lou?
So, do we have permission from the Simpsons to run that that clip?
Probably not.
Every now and then we run something on the intro that really dates us, and that's one of them. The other one is that segment where we have somebody dialing through an analog radio dial, turning the dial, and the tuner sliding across stations.
Yeah, well, that used to happen, you know.
I'm going to say that it betrays maybe the demographic that we appeal to, but I would say more than half the country right now has absolutely no idea what that sound
did
is.
Did you see the kids that they tried to make a phone call? He was in the thing. They had no idea.
Oh yeah, that's one of the funniest videos ever.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Unless you watched, you know, black and white movies, you wouldn't have any idea how to use a phone. Anyway, it's just funny to hear that segment, and I'm just, my lawyer mind takes over and says, wait a minute. That's a copyright issue. Do we have permission?
Well, there's stuff about if you're on the air, they actually buy a licensing agreement for like everybody for like songs and stuff up to like a few minutes of the song or something. There's all kinds of levels of this.
Yes. Oh, well, this all blew up again, dating myself big time when Rush Limbaugh started using the Pretenders. Ohio song is his intro, and Chrissy Hines got apparently really upset. She heard it, listened to her friends call. She hated Limbaugh, but her friends called her and said, "Hey, listen, your music's being used to promote this right wing kook." And she called her agent and said, "What's going on here?" And the agent goes, "You sold the rights, the commercial you know, whatever those commercial rights are to use the music or use a piece of the music years ago. And it was done as an entire package for your portfolio. They bought it. You know, they bought part, they subscribed to whatever. And so
yeah, the stations get to subscribe. But they can't use, they can only use, God, Louis used to know this stuff. When we were on the air, it was, I think you get to use 15 seconds, 20 seconds, something. You can't use the whole song, I don't think.
No. And I just, you know, clips like that or other stuff. I mean, it's not like are we making any money?
Oh, God, no.
I'm not even sure there's any commercial
God, no.
commercial value to what we're
well,
doing.
Well, you know, when we were on the score, my buddy John, Dr. J, decides to use the, and he's the one who did a lot of stuff for us way back one in the day, and he, you know, he was good at it. John really liked doing this stuff, and he put some of these together. That's why his voice is still on there. But he and I, you know, I don't know how to do that. Grab his stuff and piece it all together. You know,
oh well, you can do it now very easily. Well, you ask Grok or Chat or Copilot to do it.
Okay, somebody could do it. Let's put it that way. But he grabbed the one. Let's get ready to rumble.
Yes,
that guy watches that like he has teams of people waiting for anybody to use that. We used it like once, and they came down on the score. We had to pay a fine.
Yep. Then
who is that guy? The guy with the
WWE, right?
So yeah, what was the guy's name?
Oh, not McMahon.
No, he was after McMahon.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
I
was going to raise a local issue for you that I'm aware of because it affects one of my progeny. So apparently, power is out throughout almost all of northern Indiana.
Yeah.
That whole area there. I was talking to my kid, and he said, I said, are you going to try to drive into work? Is it Chicago's got electricity? And he said, no, because the roads are a nightmare.
Yeah, they're horrible.
All the lights are out. All the traffic signals are out. All the metering and everything else is shot. He was driving. He had to drive, I think, like 45 minutes to an hour. He has a Tesla, and he had to drive 45 minutes to an hour to get the car charged so that it would run. You know, power's out in his house. And I was just thinking, you know, the Chicago has Denver had, because we're becoming California, wants to electrify everything. They want to eliminate gas stoves. They want to eliminate gas heat, gas water heaters. They want to drive everything to electric, because then they can control it more easily, I think. But this whole electric future that we're all, you know, supposedly moving to is, in my opinion, nuts until we get a much more reliable grid. Because when you get a power outage like this that hits a wide area and you've driven your populace into an all-electric kind of environment, the hits that people take and the sort of unnecessary suffering that you introduce on something like this become legion. I mean, it's bad enough in the wintertime when you know you've got a heat issue and you can no longer use your gas range or stove or oven to put some heat into your house. If you've got a sump pump or something like that,
yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, you're flooding. You're flooding. You're not going to be able to keep it going. I don't know if I was broadcasting with you guys when Chicago had that terrible storm come through that knocked out power to like 500,000 or 600,000 people for a couple of days. I was one of them. I had a battery, you know, my sump pump ran on a battery that was supposed to be good for like 8 hours. The power was out for I think 4 or 5 days. I immediately ran to Home Depot and got the last of their big generators, gas generators, and set that thing up and started running it in my backyard, which my neighbors loved. But that was just to keep my sump pump going. And so this whole electric future that we are driving towards, and of course it has the same effect here that it did in Europe and in California. Our electric rates are going through the roof.
Yep,
because
absolutely.
Of the regulation here and the fact that they don't want to build nuclear plants. They just want renewables. So you know, we've got a lot of sunshine here, and renewables can help, but we also have our wind farms are not consistent because our winds are sometimes too high, and when we get clouds, it shuts down our solar, and so we don't have battery backup systems or systems to come back and back up the renewables when they don't work. And so our electric costs are going through the roof. You guys have the same issue. It's the worst of both worlds. We get a grid that cannot support the kind of demand, even when you get an occasional storm coming through, and sky high costs.
Well, the weather here has been, everybody says. I try not to be one of these guys where you see a guy run for a touchdown and he's the greatest back that ever lived, right? Because you saw him. But I will say that the I've never, I've been around a while. I've never seen a 3 or 4 or 5 week span in Chicago like we have this time.
You had 105 mile an hour wind gusts in northern Indiana.
But it's like every day in the last 3 or 4 weeks. If you have a tree left on your property, you're unusual almost. Yesterday was another. Even downtown, it was a 50 mile an hour gust. I happened to be walking from my truck. It was 80 miles an hour in the burbs.
I'm just looking at northern Indiana and where he lives. 105 mile an hour wind gust.
But Lou, this is 90, every day 90. About noon. This is like something you'd see in Africa. It's the same time. We're going to do it again today. But it's this massive wind. It's rained so hard it looks like a thing of a hurricane. And I'm not given to exaggeration, but I've been sitting in this office for 21 years. And I'll tell you what, last week and not yesterday, the day before, I've never seen it that dark at noon. It was absolutely pitch dark. I've never seen it light. It gets dark during a storm, duh. But this was this. If you looked out, you'd say, "What am I doing here at 3 a.m?"
According to something I read from the National Weather Service, you had an actual derecho come through. Which for the listeners, they've heard me mention this before. It's a consistent heavy line of thunderstorms that remains intact for like hundreds of miles. It's a violent, and it's violent. I mean, it's really violent.
It's supposed to also be rare. We've had probably 5 of those in the last 3 weeks.
Boy, that's incredible.
And you know what? Today, it's humid again, 75, 80 degrees, 85 degrees. They're talking about another one. It's going to rain here this morning. And they're saying tomorrow another one and another one on Saturday. It's the same thing every day. Whatever pattern we're in, it was like the river out in California the one year was one storm after the other.
Yeah,
it's kind of what we're in.
What's it doing to the baseball schedules?
They've been sort of okay. I'd say it's been in the middle of the day, which is even weirder. I looked at the Chicago, nothing ever changes, Lou, you want to look at. They used to be able to go to the river levels, and there's a big map, and you could hit on every one of the different, markers, and they tell you how high the water is and what flood stage is. Yeah. Well, now some genius has switched from that to amount of flow. Who the hell knows how much flow, what flow means? I don't. But every single river around here I checked, yesterday had a record flow for that date. Well, I guess that means they're in flood stage, right?
I would think so. I contrast that with what's happening in Europe right now.
Yeah,
where I saw, so we went down the Rhine River.
I thought you did the Danube. You did the Rhine?
I did. I've done both.
Okay.
So we went down the Rhine River 10 years ago, and the there's an island in the middle of the river. Where this guy built this white castle. It's famous. It's not a hamburger place. It's literally a white castle kind of structure. It's not huge.
No sliders.
But he put it in the middle of the river. Put this thing up in the river because what they would do is put a chain across the river to stop boats coming through and to make you pay a toll. So this thing sits in the middle of the river, and the river is now so low that you can walk out to this island. It is absolutely stunning. The Danube, which gets shallow in some points, is down, I think, in some places to 16 centimeters of depth. Of course, it's Europe, so it's centimeters. But that's not quite 8 inches of water.
Well, did you see the spots that have saw this on YouTube, they got these sandbars, and they're digging up all these, like, dinosaur heads and stuff.
Yep. Yep. I mean, it's a disaster. And, of course, the river, you know, my experience there is just with the river boats, but the river cruises. But, I mean, from a perspective of commerce, it is an absolute disaster.
Did you remember this? A vague memory. This had to be, we were doing the show, it's 4 or 5 years ago. The Mississippi got down so low, and then all of a sudden, one day, it all this rain in Pennsylvania, and below the Ohio River, it went up, what, like 8 feet in 8 hours or something?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's possible. So I've taken a couple of river trips, and one of them was on the Elbe River, which is Germany, Czechoslovakia, Germany. And we were operating, so the tech, I think I may have mentioned this before on the show, but the technology on these river boats is incredible. And so I was talking to the captain of our vessels. We're crawling along through this very, very shallow river.
Did he let you drive?
And I said, pardon me?
Did he let you drive?
They let you up in the bridge.
Oh,
that's so insane. I was talking to him as we were motoring along, and I said, what, you know, just out of curiosity, how much water do we actually need? And he said, well, if it's and remember, okay, so this is like a 150-foot long boat with, you know, 250 people on board.
But it's flat bottom, though. It's like a barge.
It's a flat bottom, and this, yeah. but it's you know, and it's built low, so it can pass under the bridges, so it doesn't have a high profile. But he said, I can if we've got a meter. I think a meter 30, 1 meter 30 centimeters, which is
4 feet, maybe.
I think 4 feet. He said, I can run the boat anywhere. If it drops below that, I have to like 1 meter 25, I have to go to my first level supervisor to get permission to operate. And if it goes to 1 meter 20, then I have to go to the corporate headquarters to get permission to.
Well, but
he
has to. If it's 1 meter 30, I mean, I'm not, no one, I'm thinking about the Chicago River where they found the 40 cars in there. If he hits a rugby ball that somebody threw in there, he's going to hit the rugby ball, right? If it's sitting on the bottom.
Yep. And of course they've charted, because they run those routes all the time. They chart them regularly, but the sandbars, because it's a river, sandbars move.
Yep.
And
well, they really move in the lake. The lake's like alive, Lake Michigan.
Yeah. They're constantly checking and running, you know, depth gauge. Of course, they've got an instantaneous depth gauge readout. But he also said that you have to be careful, because the water levels are deceptive in two ways. First of all, he said it's not unusual if we get rain up in Bavaria, 24 hours later, we've got a 12 inch or 12 centimeter to 20 centimeter surge in the water level. Just, it's like a pulse coming down the, like a tidal bore coming down the river. It's this extra water pours in. And then he said, we have to be careful too, because our bow pushes water out of the way as we're going down the river. And that actually lowers the water level for the boat. And it's, in normal times, it's almost imperceptible. You don't really worry about it. But when you're getting to within one or two, you know, inches of actual being able to go and maneuver safely, that bow push and that little bitty drop in the level of the water in front of the ship makes enough of a difference that we have to factor it in as we're navigating.
Hey, I gotta ask you, I'm gonna shift topics a hair here and talk about the lake.
Short answer. For people in northern Indiana and in Chicago and in these major metropolitan areas that are pushing everybody to go electric, if you can afford it, buy yourself a backup generator. They're expensive. I mean, like a power vac or something like that. The battery backup system that Tesla sells.
Well, if you the I don't understand, and this is not a left or right issue, because I've listened to some of these people in their campaigns. Somehow or another, Lou, and I don't know, I'm not going to go crazy on this, but Dr. Johnson was talking about it the other day. We have totally lost, I mean, not totally, in my opinion, we've really lost, I'm going to say the I don't know if it was the World War II generation, but the idea of, you know, I'm going to say mostly guys, but it could be women too, obviously. The whole concept of thinking through a problem before you propose your solution seems to be an absolute lost art.
You know why?
Well, I don't. It's been going on for quite a while, so I really don't.
It has. This goes back to one of my favorite themes, Tom, and the listeners will object because I've said it so many times. We have ideologues running many of our public policy, or making many of our public policy decisions. And ideologues, when they are confronted by reality, i.e., their ideology doesn't work in the real world or is leads to a whole host of other problems that they didn't anticipate, their response is not to adjust their worldview. It's to double down on the ideology.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And this is true, right wing, left wing, it's true across the board.
I sure as hell not going to disagree with you on that, but the question is, how do you get there? When you go to school, I don't know what they learn these days, but you know, maybe I had a different path. But every almost starting in like sixth grade, it was like, okay, if you do this, what happens? I mean, you don't just, this is my opinion, I'm sticking to it. No, okay, let's follow your opinion a little bit. If we do this, what happens here? Simple question, like, we'd like everything to be all electric. Okay, where are you going to get the power? It's a very simple question.
And then we immediately, if we say we immediately impose limits that on what we can do. So we're going to shut down global warming because we don't want to stop burning stuff. That's BS science, but in any of it, that's the ideology. And so you say to yourself, okay, fine. We need non-burning sources of electricity. Okay, great. Let's build a nuclear power plant. Oh no, we can't do that. Because we don't like nukes. And nuclear power generates all kinds of bad stuff. Well, we can deal with that. But it doesn't matter. We don't want it. But if you go with renewables, you're not getting the kind of consistent power source that you need to power the grid that you've designed right now. Well, we'll just have to build more. But we're not going to have any nukes. Look what happened in Germany.
Well, I know. I'm saying it, but on a certain level, without even getting to the level you're on, the high chessboard, my curse, a lot of people, you know, take these problems from the top down and they work them. I'm not accusing you of that, but I always took them the bottom up. What about what's one guy going to do with this tax law? What's it going to make him do?
But that makes perfect sense, Tom, because what you're doing, you look at it and you say, all right, here come all the unintended consequences. Because I'm looking at what a normal person reacting to the incentives that you're building into the system with your ideological worldview, I'm looking at what the incentives are once you put this plan in place. Because the incentives are going to drive
I don't want anything like incentives. I want stuff to happen when it's supposed to happen. But I mean, I want to be even simpler. I want to say, okay, I've got a gas furnace. What is the efficiency of this gas furnace? And they're pretty friggin' high now. By the way, so are cars now. You know, I'm not talking about the big SUV with one guy riding it like me, but talking about what is the? I mean, I remember going skiing at Steamboat when I was young, and they didn't have any natural gas up there, and they all used electricity to heat the places. Their electric bills back then were like $300 a month.
And you froze,
or your boots touched the thing, and your boots melted. Remember that? They were so hot, those things on the radiators, those electric radiators. So what I want to know, the question is, all right, now, if I have the latest and greatest gas furnace or gas stove. What is my efficiency on this furnace? I've heard ratings 85-90%. You know, I don't know if they're that high. I want to know the question. Okay, if you now burn this natural gas in a one of those, you know, for the electric company, burns the natural gas, how far away do they have to be where if you put it on the wires to come over to my place, the stuff degrades every mile on the wire, right? I mean, if the gas, you know, if the gas boiler the electric company uses is a mile away, they might be able to tell me, yeah, it's more efficient to use electric and actually heat stuff in your house. I doubt that, but give me the number. What's the number? There's no way on earth that burning some kind of fossil fuel gas or whatever 30 miles from my home or 100 miles from my home and shipping me electricity is more efficient than a gas furnace. There's no way that's true. There just isn't. You know, where are you getting the power? And everybody looks at you, well, it just comes from someplace. Well, no, it's not going to be all renewable. It's not going to be this or that. You know, and what about nuclear? Well, we don't want nuclear. We don't want this.
That's right. Or from a public policy perspective, if we have all these renewables, if you're the electric company, you come in and say, fine, what happens when it's the wind stops or it's night and it's 85 degrees at night at 10 p.m. and the sun's down? Yeah. So our solar system isn't working. We got to have something to back it up, which means we have to build the same number of power plants that we have now to generate the same amount of electricity, because we have to have that capability when the renewables go down. That's the whole idea about renewables, is they're not consistent. We either need power plants or we need some kind of storage, and we don't have that, and we're not building it.
Why in areas, and this is the part that it flabbergasts me. You hear these, and we do it on the show, probably too much. We argue about this, or we discuss it. We don't argue about anything. Yet the one time I drove back in my red pickup truck from Tucson, and I'm driving across northern Arizona and northern New Mexico, and I'm going, the sun seems relentless, the wind is relentless, and yet we got diesel-powered locomotives pushing that train. For this 400-mile set, why the hell don't we have electric locomotives? Or if you go by Hoover Dam and now the water level's so low, they're worried about their electric capacity. And yet you can look to the, I think it's the Northwest, there's got to be the flattest valley on earth. It has to be 40 miles, the sun baking on the place, and it's flat as a pancake, and there isn't one solar collector out there with the power, with the wires from the dam right there. If ever you're going to put a solar collector someplace, why not there? And yet there's nothing there. I mean, whatever common sense we have on both ends of this, we're idiots. On one hand, we're trying to make solar power in a place like in northern Wisconsin. Good luck with that. Or we're not doing it in a place that has sun 364 days a year, all day long, to the point where you're frying.
Because your transmission costs.
Well, they're right there. You get the lines, all the lines on earth. The dam's right there, for God's sake.
But your generating costs out there are exorbitant.
For what?
And for building the facility. I mean, they've done that, Tom. They've built. There's a big solar collector place out in Southern California, and it's shut down. It wasn't economical.
I know what I'm saying. If any place it could ever, let me rephrase. If it's not economical there, where could it be?
Yeah, well, it has. I don't know the exact mechanics of it, but I do know that to the extent that one of the side effects of the artificially high electric rates that are being generated in places like California and are soon to be Colorado is that you get people to put solar panels up on their homes. That's one way of doing it.
That's a horrible idea. Don't think costs so much and it doesn't get you much
back. I know, but that's what's that. I understand, but the costs of electricity being, as I said, artificially inflated are such that those panels can become economic. I get it.
Probably what I'm saying, if you try and ship power from Dakota, where they got all these wind farms, to Chicago, okay, now you get into this absolute political brouhaha. How good are the lines? Well, the lines aren't so good. Well, you could use high-capacity lines. All right, well, Commonwealth Edison doesn't want to help pay for it because they'd rather use their own stuff here than buy it from you cheaper. So now who's going to pay for the lines? Who's going to pay for the grid? It's a long it's a long story of a million variables. But if you find a place that already has the lines, and there's nothing but sun, if you can't make it work there, how are you going to make it work anywhere?
Agreed.
We had a big sale in sports yesterday, and of course your man Trump's kids are involved, which you know bothers a little bit.
You understand that this is the brother of his son-in-law.
Yeah, it's close enough.
Who is vehemently anti-Trump?
Not really.
And his wife too. These people are not Republicans. They are vehemently.
This is one. This is the brother of the guy who's our emissary.
Yep. Kushner. Yep.
Well, how did he get? Anyway, well, whoever. I want to go through the.
He's a self-made gazillionaire. So that's
when your dad's that wealthy, there's no such thing as self-made, is there?
Whatever. He's a competent investor.
Let's keep the political part out. I want to just go through. When you look at these numbers, and I try once in a while, I don't go too deep into it because I don't know if the listeners really want it. Whenever anybody makes a purchase of anything, because I used to do this, you know, for a couple of places. Whenever you make a purchase of any kind, certainly if it's a piece of capital equipment or something, you need a view of your future, of what that's going to do for you, of what the economy, what the world's going to look like. Hell, if you buy a machine that's going to last you 30 years, I mean, nobody has an accurate 30-year plan, but you got to have something, right, to figure out, is this a good buy or not?
Yeah, return on investment, sure.
I mean, if you know that the world's biggest meteor is going to slam into New York 6 months from now, you're probably not going to do it, right? So at least part of your worldview is the world's still going to be here. Let's start with that, right? You know, what it's going to look like, who knows? But the same thing comes to numbers, and I'm very careful to never give investment advice on the show because, A, I'm not supposed to, and, B, I don't want to give advice to people I don't know because God knows if they listen to me and it's the wrong thing for them. So I don't do it. But once in a while, I'll just pick a stock that maybe is, in my opinion, is not necessarily overvalued. But what I'm saying is this is what you're expecting to happen. This is what you're buying and your view of the future. And I mentioned Palantir the other day. At this price, at this revenue per share, this earnings per share, it looks really strange, like 10 times too high kind of thing. Doesn't mean the people buying now are wrong. Their view is this place is going to continue to double every year for the next 10 years. And guess what? If they're right, the thing could be a bargain. But it comes down to your view. Now, we've had, you know, and I don't want to go too deep into this, we've had a time since really probably 1982, certainly 87, absolutely since 2000, and on steroids since 2007, where we have, despite what our buffoons right and left say about the CPI, we have an inflationary period because money is pouring into the system way faster than population or efficiency is growing. When I say way faster, it could be 3-4%. That's all it needs. And we have this inflationary stuff where if you're not involved in the group that gets the money, meaning, you know, resorts, say, if you're in the right place, stocks, housing maybe, clearly baseball teams, football teams, those kinds of things. If you're in that group, the world is your oyster, okay? Now the question is, how is that going to keep going? So now I'm going to ask you about this Lakers. For those that don't know, the Lakers traded yesterday, the team, at say $12 billion. All right, so that's a lot of dough. All right, so I'm here looking at 2026 CNBC's official NBA team valuations. Well, I don't care what they think the valuations are, but I'm looking at the Los Angeles Lakers. Their revenue, according to these guys, let's take it for fact. Who knows if it's right or not? They claim the revenue is $560 million, and their earnings are like $160. Okay, so $12 billion. I'll just go through the math real quick, and then I'm going to ask Professor Liu if he's making this presentation to the potential buyers, what exactly is he telling them? Okay, so the way I calculate $12 billion, we're talking 20 times revenue, maybe 19. Okay, now that's a stretch, all right? Anywhere. And it's got to be, what's that, 100 times? 100 times earnings? 120 times earnings?
Yes.
And if you were to take the $12 billion and somebody immediately is going to say, well, these guys got the dough, they don't care. Well, of course, people have dough because they do care, not because they don't care. But if you want to go out and borrow that money at 6%, which, you know, you'd have to be pretty good to do since your 30-year rate is 5, over 5 in the Treasury, you'd have to be a pretty big dog to get 6%. But let's be nice and say it's 6%. You're talking, what's your interest rate, for God's sake? Your interest payment for a year, what, at 10%, it's, what, it's $1.2 billion. So at 6%, it's going to be, what, $800 million, which is way more than your revenue and four times more than your earnings. Okay, so my question is, Lou, what is the view of the world of these people to pay that money? I'm not saying it's a bad buy. No, but they must have the view of the world that the last 10, 15, 7 years is going to continue. That every year, who's ever president is going to pour money into the system, the market's going to continue to accelerate, we're going to have inflation, but we're going to lie about it, and somehow or another, this top group of people are going to be richer than the dreams of avarice. That actually, what they're really saying is if the tickets are $150 now, in 5 years, the tickets are going to be like $600. Or something, or 550. And oh, by the way, the revenue is going to be $5 billion, not $565 million. What kind of worldview do you think that is, Lou? And do you think does it make any sense at all?
I think the world. Well, so this guy, the Kushner,
whoever it is, it could have been you and me.
No, I'm just saying he's also an owner in two other major sports franchises that I'm aware of. So he's not an inexperienced investor in the sports area. I think what they do is they look at it from a couple of perspectives. Number one, they look at it from a leveraging perspective. This ownership of this club will open doors for me in other places that will help me make up whatever shortfall we're going to see in the LA market. Number two, the market that I'm looking at is not ticket sales. The market that I'm looking at is television streaming sales and how I can leverage that revenue stream with the LA market and you know what I can get from the NBA for the LA market.
Okay, but you got to put numbers on this.
I don't know those numbers and I don't have them in front of me, but I mean this is when I've talked to people who worked on deals like this, this is the mindset. You know, what are we looking at? I look at the projections for the purchasing Laker games with an NBA games, with ESPN, with Amazon, with HBO, with Netflix, with YouTube, and I see the fracturing of these large scale deals that basically result in my product being sold in multiple marketplaces against multiple competitors, which means that they're going to pay up to get my product. I look at my merchandising for Lakers stuff, which I will represent to you, having been in Southeast Asia less than 5 months ago. I saw LA Lakers jerseys in a number of places in Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, and even Hong Kong. Maybe especially Hong Kong because they love basketball there. So if you're him, you're saying, I've got an expanding market. We're global. The NBA is a global product. We're expanding that. We are expanding our reach across multiple media platforms, and the competition among those media platforms is getting bigger, not smaller. I'm in a market that's not going anywhere anytime soon, the Los Angeles market, although I'd be careful about that. And so I've got a great facility. I own all this, you know, this land and capital assets. And I've got a product that is selling out. So here we are. This looks like a good investment to me. I mean, that's the mentality. You ask what their mentality is. That's the mentality.
Okay, and I'm going to agree with everything you said, but I'm still going to ask him one question. Put a number on it. If you have a, if you have a, an economy where, no matter what people say, the amount of inflation is ahead of people's earnings growth. So are we saying that the normal schlump, like Jimmy and me, is going to be paying $100 a month on my phone to watch Lakers games? I don't know. I don't think I'm going to do that. But then again, I'm a Luddite. I know that. But I mean, who is it? We're talking about our plan is, you know, I mean, again, I don't want to be political here, but do we really see a world in which the people in Korea can pay $300 for a Lakers T-shirt 10 years from now? I don't know. I don't see that.
Okay.
But I'm saying they're seeing something. And I'd like, let's put it this way. If you're asking me for the $12 billion, and I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think that is what they're thinking, but, okay, I got a ticking time bomb here. My interest rate is $400 million above my revenue. You can't just say 20 years from now everybody's going to be streaming Laker games. You got to tell me who's paying what, where, and how it gets to me.
So in addition to this, and this, and you and I have talked about this before, you know, there is a psychic value attached to being a major sports owner. And as I said, this is going to open, you know, the fact that he's a Lakers owner is going to open doors for him in investment opportunities and business opportunities all over the world. It's like owning. Why would anybody own a soccer club, a soccer team in Europe?
Okay, what I'm getting with the difference where you're talking as a lawyer and a man for the future, and I'm talking as the accountant, and I'm saying, okay, if I think the thing is actually worth $7 billion, and all this other stuff happens, and all of a sudden I get invited everywhere, and I get invited in other investments, you know, if I can pull it off, I'll pay 7, 5, or 8. I mean, you're not going to get any argument out of me that there isn't some premium to being a team owner. I think there really is.
Sure, there is.
But what's the number? Is it $20 billion? Is it 50? Is it 100?
It's the same. It's the same number, or the calculation is the same if I want to buy a Van Gogh. I see this Van Gogh painting come up for auction, and I go, I want that painting. And the last sale price for the Van Gogh was X. But you know, I really want that painting. So even though my accountant is telling me this thing is not going to appreciate past X plus 5, because I want that thing, it's beautiful, I want to be able to hang it in my house, I want to be able to have people look at it, I want to point to it and say, that's mine, I'm willing to pay X plus 10.
So
that's the mindset.
The economic definition of that is it's both an investment and a consumption good.
Sure.
The guy wants it, okay? But what I'm saying is there still has to be some sort of, in the last, I'm going to say since 2007, any purchase of one of these places, given what the policy has been, through four presidents who I think knew nothing about what they were doing in a lot of ways, economically anyway. They did other stuff that was pretty good, all of them, some of them. If you want to trade the last 19 years, you would pay any price for one of these places. Now the question is the next 19 years going to be like that? Are the tickets going to quadruple in 5 years? I'm going to say no. I'll lob that one in there. I don't think, the way I see the economy going, that, now it's a small group that goes in there out of the whole part of LA, and you're going to have some businesses that have the tickets. Is every man going to be able to pay $600 for a ticket 10 years from now? The way I see the growth going, I'm saying I'm taking a fade on that. And you know, and I buy the marquee for the Cubs, and I know a couple of them I don't get from Apple, and I know that the revenue is growing. But is a regular person going to pay, what do I pay now? I probably pay $10 a month for them. Am I going to pay 50? No. I mean, I the hell with them. I mean, if I did, I'm only going to do it for the 3 months in the summer or four.
But you might not have, I suspect there are people that buy Amazon Prime or Netflix just for a sporting event.
I'm sure there are.
but there aren't very many.
Well,
most people buy it as a package.
I mean,
so the cost of the actual purchase for the Lakers games is diffused significantly, so that you're not feeling it directly.
But for the last,
when I say directly, I mean you're not feeling it consciously.
Well, you're describing essentially psychic income, right?
Yes.
Okay, but if it's you and me, if we had actually in a normal event where some people didn't get this massive wealth because of what's happened in the last 19 years, you and I, even if say we had half the money, we're not gonna take a $6 billion loan, knowing our income is not gonna cover the interest on the loan just for psychic income. We can't do that, right? How could we? I mean, we'd have to really.
Again, the psychic income is part of it, but the psychic income is not all of it. And I mean, part of the psychic income, at least you, in your estimation, or in the buyer's estimation, is going to translate into actual income, as I've said, with the influence and the notoriety and the door-opening capability of being a major sports team owner.
People
will convince themselves of that.
Well, without a doubt. But you and I were talking like a cost accountant versus attorney, which is fine. That's exactly why I brought up the conversation. Is on one level, if we get this loan, all right, and all of a sudden it comes time to pay the interest, and guess what? Our interest check bounces. The bank's going to say, okay, where's the psychic income? I mean, I understand that you have people like, what is the lady from Las Vegas Sands that bought into Mark Cuban's thing?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not positive. I think the story was her dad died. She didn't have to pay any taxes on the stock. She sold some in Las Vegas Sands. So it was a massive amount of inherited wealth with no taxes. And, oh, by the way, you know, I mean, the lady never made $500 million as you know, working on an assembly line. That ain't happening. But somehow or another, they, you know, and there's a lot of that going on. And my question is, nobody even thinks, I guess we'll change subjects here in a minute, nobody even thinks that train is going to stop. You know, what if, you know, this actually happened once in our lifetime, and I can't remember the years, but I can remember the... Remember when the Cubs signed Soriano?
Yes.
Whatever year that was. And they gave him this plan. And this is always kind of my example in here. They gave him this contract. It was, you know, it was like $8 million a year back when nobody made $8 million a year, for God's sake. But they made the world view that in 8 years, he's not going to be on a scale of 1 to 10, he's not going to be an 8 outfielder anymore, because the guy was a hell of a player. And he's going to be a 5. But you know what? In 8 years or 10 years, a guy who's a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10 is going to be making $10 million. Our view of the world is, you know, this business and the economy's got the world by the tail, and we're going straight up. And guess what? It didn't for that period of time. I forget what years these were. And all of a sudden, Soriano actually played very well for the Cubs. At the end of his career, he was being booed because he was making $8 million, and they could have gotten somebody just as good at that point for 3 or 4, and plus another 4 players. And that's why people booed him, not because he didn't hustle, not because he wasn't a good guy, not because he wasn't a decent ball player. The Cubs totally misguessed the next 8-year future. And it's probably the only time in the last 20 years that people have done that when it comes to baseball teams and whatever, but it has happened in our lifetime. So, I mean, what if these guys, and you know, again, if it's cash money from something else, I guess maybe they don't care. What if these guys, what if we go into some kind of a, God, I hope we don't, some sort of a recession where 10 years from now the market is the same place it is now, which has happened, by the way, twice in my lifetime. And all of a sudden, the value of the Lakers 10 years from now is still $12 billion. And oh, by the revenue is roughly the same. Good Lord, how much are these guys sucking on this $12 billion? Yeah. But nobody's even thinking of that, are they?
Well, I mean, you know, fortune favors the bold, right?
Yeah. Well, but so, they've had, the wind is, I guess what I'm trying to say here, and I know it's hard for me to get to it, the wind at your back has been this national policy of breathing money into the system and inflating asset prices. That's been the wind at your back. And somehow or another, we've gotten away with the inflation, and we've gotten away with, you know, beating up on 80% of the population. I don't know that that goes on another 15 years. I don't know if it can. I don't know what the, I hope it's not an armed revolution, but I don't see another 10 years, and I hope it's at the ballot box, of inflation being 4% and people's income going up too. I don't see that. Like, I don't see how that can happen quietly. Do you?
I'm you've got the better crystal ball than I do. But let me pitch something out to go back to your ideology, our ideology discussion in terms of people ignoring reality in a sports context. And that's what's happening with the WNBA. And I'm not going to get
without a doubt.
I'm not going to get into it. You know, we can bash the WNBA all day, but I just you have ideologues running the WNBA and playing in the WNBA at a lot of different levels, coaching at a lot of different levels, and they are somehow, because of their ideology, committed to this idea that we are not going to come out and say that trans, and I'm always confused whether it's trans men or trans women, but in any event, we are not going to say no to having men who have, quote, transitioned, unquote, to become women. We are not going to exclude those people from playing. We're not going to say
there isn't anybody playing now, basketball. Is there? There's nobody now. Pardon me? There's nobody like that now playing, is there?
There is supposedly a trans player in the WNBA now, but it's a woman who believes she's a man. So I think that actually makes their position logically even more difficult, because they under their definition, they have a man, that is somebody who's declared themselves to be a man, playing in the league. So
well, they may declare that, but they're whatever.
I know. Well, I know. And of course, the point is, it's a willful ignoring of ignorance or just blowing past reality, because of course it's a woman. If it was a real man, if it was a genetic man playing in the WNBA, he'd be killing people, and you're seeing this crazy choice being forced now with Kantner and Royce White, who have said, listen, we'll come on and play, and we've declared ourselves to be women, and that is all it takes, based on the statements from the commissioner and most of the coaches.
Boy, I don't get this.
What's hilarious is the WNBA had a big meeting, I think yesterday or earlier in the week, where they got the team executives, the coaches, they all got in some conclave somewhere, either online or in person, to look at this issue. Now, in a normal world where you're in reality, that discussion should have lasted 30 seconds. Ladies and gentlemen, we're not going to allow biological men to play in our league. Okay? End of discussion.
What if you have somebody in the room saying, for the first year, this guy is going to sell out every arena?
I don't know if that.
It wouldn't work.
That works as long as there's only one of them.
I'm saying that there. Don't ever leave the money out of these people's discussion.
Well, I'm not. But you know. Wait a minute. We're talking about the WNBA.
Yeah.
They've hamstrung their biggest draws. They've killed them. They've tried to drive Caitlin Clark out of the league. They tried to shut her down. She fills arenas, but the WNBA doesn't want.
Well, nobody's supposed to say it, but there's the gender issues. Oh God, I don't want to go on this road.
But my point is,
stop me from saying
this is a league that is not acting in its economic best interest,
because they have factions in the league. And you know what I'm talking about?
Oh yes, yeah. The love that dare not speak its name.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, you know, I think there's people in the NBA and the NFL that are gay. That I'm sure there are. I mean, I don't know. But you know what?
It
makes no difference. There's no
because if you can ball, you can ball.
Yeah.
And that's all we care
but
about.
There's
but that's not what they care about in the WNBA.
Yeah, there's somewhat of a difference in the personality.
It's not somewhat. Yeah. It's a major difference.
Major difference. And it's been in college ball forever, and nobody can talk about it.
Yeah. No, it's a huge issue in college ball. But my point is that you have a league that is acting completely crazy in terms of its economic best interest and has done so for the last 3 or 4 years. And everybody watched it play out when Clark stepped onto the court for the first time. And they now are for some reason, because of ideology and ideological mindset, they are absolutely refusing to say what everybody understands they need to say, which is, we're not going to allow biological men to come in here because this is the Women's National Basketball Association. If we allow men to play, then they will, I mean, they'll kill us.
We also probably don't want ladies of a different persuasion to not like straight ladies in the league either.
I'm sure that's a factor, but here's some numbers for you, and I'll leave it at this. You know what the average compensation is in the NBA's G League, which is the semi-pro league, one level below the NBA? The average salary there is $45,000 a year.
It's $45,000.
You know what the average salary? You know what the average salary is under the new collective bargaining agreement for the WNBA? It's $500,000 a year. Is there any doubt in your mind that a G League player could step onto an NBA court and blow people away?
Those guys are so good, it's scary.
There's Tom.
The last guy at the Bulls on the Bulls bench is 10 times better than the best player I ever played against. I know that. Most people don't.
Well, the last guy on the Bulls bench, or the first guy off the Bulls bench, is 100 times better than the best NBA player right now, and would absolutely dominate. And so you now have, I mean, if this thing goes, if they don't draw a line somewhere, you literally could have a flood of guys going out and buying wigs and showing up for the WNBA draft.
How do they pay those people that much money? They make that kind of dough?
$500,000 a year. Yeah. That's the average compensation.
That's what I'm saying. Are they making that kind of money?
No. The NBA subsidizes the WNBA to millions a year, tens of millions a year.
Why?
Because they want a virtue signal.
Ah.
They want to say, look, this is ideology, Tom. This is the ideological mindset.
That's really something. Hey, what? We got a few minutes here. We got a couple minutes. We got 1 minute. What is going on over in the Strait of Hormuz? I'm hearing, I read because of the pipelines and everything else, almost as much oil is coming out of the area as before. Then you look at the amount of ships going through the Strait, and it's nowhere near what people say they're going through there. I mean, what the hell? I mean, can all this be true?
So what's happening is you're seeing, and I would love to think this is part of our strategy, you are seeing a long-term shift in oil delivery and basically isolating Iran's ability to market its oil and control that strait. And as these pipelines get built, as these alternate ways of delivery come up, as our blockade is maintained, Iran has stopped loading tankers at Karg Island, is what the last report I read, because they can't store the oil.
Well, the oil market doesn't believe that. It's up to $85.
I get it. But you're seeing a shakeout there. But I'm just telling you that
actually Iran, we're down to 81.50. Sorry, we were
Iran is, or this blockade is having a significant economic effect on Iran, and I think that's one of the reasons why the president's saying, you know what, we don't have to expend any more munitions. We can just sit.
Well, we also
and we'll let their economy crater.
But
the long term impact is going to be to basically isolate Iran's ability to do the only thing that it can do, which is control the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, we'll talk about it more next week, but we keep searching for new directions in this thing. It was supposed to go over in 2 days.
I agree. Yeah. Like I said, I'd love to think this was the direction all along, but I mean, we were talking about this three, 4 months ago, And it just apparently has taken longer. But anyway, but you guys have a great weekend. Stay dry.
Stay away from the fires and all the other stuff going on out there, for God's sake.
Yeah, we've actually got rain here, so it's starting to tamp down. It's you guys I'm worried about. Hope your power stays on.
We don't have a sump pump, so we got that going for us. So
okay, take care.
Do we have our guys?
Yeah. Good morning.
Are you guys part of the group that bought the Lakers for $12 billion?
No, but interesting discussion you had.
Well, isn't that, we talk a lot on the show from various people, and when you dig into the detail and stuff like this, and this is what Lou and I kind of started out with, we seem to have lost. I don't know if it's growing up or school or whatever, but even when you fixed your bike when you were 8 years old, you had to have the tools, you had to have the stuff, and you had to go try it out and see if it ran. And if it didn't, you went back to the drawing board. I don't see on any side of the aisle anybody really having the ability or the inclination to work through everything they're talking about and see what the effects of it's actually going to be. Everybody just lobs this stuff out there, hoping people like it and it sounds good or something. But politicians have kind of always been like that, but. Does anybody really think anything through? It doesn't appear they do, or is it just to me, maybe because I'm
locked in? Let me weigh in for a moment quickly on that. Okay, so you're talking about the old days and your example, fixing your bike. This is a very controlled environment where good Midwest values, you got a problem, you see a solution, it's self-contained. But Hollywood has always had wild factors, and even more so now with high tech and so forth. And so this is a world of image, of fantasy, of huge bucks for a few, and financial disaster for most people. And so, yeah, we want to operate from our youthful experiences, or even young adult or middle career, but the applicability to the world of big bucks, fantasies, and other multi-billion dollar deals, it's hard. Now, you, in the previous segment, you were talking about, what about the interest rate payments before the fantasy comes true? Well, that's why when you think about some of the actual history of Hollywood sports team owners, a lot of times it's financial disaster.
Yeah, well. But yeah, it is. We've gone through, even if nobody wants to pay any attention to my numbers game. In a world where there haven't really been any interest rates for a while, well, you had to pay on your credit card, but you never really got, which is sort of weird. But the idea, I mean, in when I broke into the business world, if you were to say to me, I'm going to give you $1 million 15 years from now, when interest rates are 15%, you almost said, don't bother. What's the point? What was it worth today? 200. You know, 200 grand, maybe 150. Maybe there always was a discount on stuff, but now we get to the point where nobody even thinks of that. When I say to somebody, "Boy, what if you actually had to borrow the $12 billion? What would you have to pay?" They go, "Well, what do you mean borrow? They own some stock. They did this. The wealth went up. It's like trading megabucks. It's like people trading houses now. If an older couple sells their place that they bought 30 years ago, they buy cash for the next place. It has nothing to do with being $500,000 that they, quote, never really earned.
Exactly. And remember, I think the sale price just 13 months ago for the Lakers was $2 billion less, you know, $10 billion and change. So we're talking about, you know, $1.5 billion more or $2 billion more just in a year. And, you know, obviously they got to come up with the money. And maybe they're counting on, despite the politics that Lou mentioned of the family, but maybe they're counting on investment from the Middle East or something like that. But again, the bean counters, the people trying to make it work, say, even to the minority partners, how are you going to make these first payments?
Well, if everybody writes a check because they sold some other stock, you know, I guess it's okay, you know. But even so, the idea that rich people don't care is the reason why they're rich is because they do care, right?
I mean, that was funny what you said.
Well, but how many people do we know? You know, guys like, you know, and I don't know them personally, but guys like, you know, Dallas and those kinds of places, they think the next buck is important as the first buck. You know, where I think, say, a guy like Wayne, if you give him $20 million, I bet he might even buy a round. He wouldn't say it's your turn.
I think he's quiet because he's planning on buying Los Angeles Clippers as his next move.
Well, you know, these guys, by the way, this was a few months ago, CNBC's team valuation, they actually got the Golden State Warriors as number one. And these guys were off by a couple bill, like you said. They got the Warriors up by worth 11, Knicks worth 10.2, Lakers worth 10. But then it drops right down, way down. The Clippers 6.9, the Bulls 6.5. So those three teams are in rarefied air, the Golden State, the Knicks, and the Lakers. And then there's a whole bunch of teams, like 10 of them here, right around 6. And then this is CNBC. Then you drop down into the lowest is the Memphis Grizzlies at 3.7, Timberwolves 3.8. So they're roughly a third of the value of the big market teams. So Oklahoma's 4.25, and you can see why they didn't get a call during the playoffs. Huh? They're not worth as much as the Knicks. You wonder how that plays in, don't you? Raptors worth 5. So it's those three, then a bunch at 6, and then there's a bunch at 5 and a couple at 4. So that's kind of what the whole mess is, because they share revenue, right? The numbers
and a lot of it has to do with the media markets, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're talking about that. How many people in Arkansas and northern Mississippi can afford big sports packages on their cable?
Well, you get a split of the national money, though.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, who was the guy? Oh God, Wayne will remember. Actually, Jimmy will remember this. When the ABA jumped into the NBA, only four teams were allowed in, and some guy from, I thought he was from St. Louis.
That was before my time.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
It was. Chief, you're right. There are two brothers from St. Louis that made a deal on the media rights for the thing. They had no team, because their team was not part of it, and it was just recently that the NBA finally bought them out for $2.5 billion. But they were visionaries. They thought of not only the media, they thought of the gaming rights, all of this, cable TV. This is back in, what, 76?
Yeah, they said you can have our players without a team, but you got to give us the media rights like we still had a team.
Correct. And so they had a percentage of the NBA like a team without owning a team, and it wasn't until about 5 years ago that they finally got bought out by the NBA for about $2.5 billion, considering all that time they were getting a check for not even owning anything.
Isn't that the beauty of it? Now, why, Wayne, didn't you get a deal like that?
You know, I have trouble balancing my own checkbook.
Well, Andrew's the attorney. He's the smartest one. He should have got something like that. you get all the media rights from a team without even having a team. That's beautiful, isn't it?
Well, let me do a little history, because both then a little bit, but particularly now, I've followed the cable industry's development. And it's useful for any younger members of the audience to know that in the mid-70s, the cable industry was not just entrepreneurial, small-time sector, but it was treated very badly by the regulators who were primarily interested in kowtowing to broadcasters. And so it was very, very hard for people to envision that cable would be as successful as it became, because it was denigrated as pay TV. We don't want pay TV in America. It's like pay toilets. It's un-American. But ultimately, they had a product that people wanted. But if you were a visionary then, you probably deserved kudos and money for sticking with it, because it was a tough landscape.
Well, you also had to put wires everywhere, which is a big deal. I mean, if you were to look at, I'll take 30 seconds, and everybody talks about why you know the Cubs are so popular, and why you know the Sox. Well, you know, they got a really good team this year, and I've always liked them. You know, I'm more of a Cub fan, but still, I've always watched the Sox. Why the difference was, and you as a Chicagoan, back when I was very young, you came home from school. Jack Brickhouse was on Channel 9, and Channel 9 did both the Sox and the Cubs. Because the league always was, one of them was in town and one of them was out of town. So the home team was on TV, and Jack Brickhouse would go from place to place. And finally, WGN, Channel 9, decided they wanted to pick one team and do every one of their games, road and home. Now, what it used to cost them before there were satellites to send, you know, video over phone lines, I don't even want to know, because it had to be like a lot of dough. But Channel 9 was housed up on the north side within like 2-3 miles of Wrigley, so they essentially picked the Cubs. And the Sox were basically bleep out of luck. There was no other station. So finally, Channel 30, the UHF came in, and they were like the next couple stations, VHF being 2, 5, 7, and 9, and UHF was a different signal. And then you had UHF stations. Well, the Sox ended up on Channel 32 for a while. And then Eddie Einhorn, who was Reinsdorf's original partner, he was a cable pioneer. And he said, okay, well, the Sox are going to go on cable. The only problem was the city wasn't wired yet. Only the suburbs were. So the Sox fans degraded down to, you know, the people that lived in Bridgeport that hated all everybody else because everybody else was a Cub fan, and people from the suburbs. And the Sox relied on people essentially taking the train home and driving back to the city for a game, which really didn't want to work out too well. So finally, after a long period of time, the city became wired and the Sox started to pick up some fans again. It had nothing to do with somebody liking the Cubs versus the Sox. The Cubs were on national TV before anybody else. If you were sitting in a saloon in Oklahoma at 2 p.m, on the TV was a Cub game, right? And that's why the Cubs became the national team, because of WGN. And then afterward became Turner. But the Sox essentially were not on TV in the city for how many years, Andrew? 15? I mean, there were pockets of the city were getting wired, but the city wasn't done being wired to what, 90? 80, 95? It took forever.
A similar thing with Ted Turner, who was in Atlanta. And he developed this superstation using satellite technology. And, of course, he made his baseball team, a local baseball team, it helped go national because that's where CNN was headquartered. That's where Ted Turner was, and that was the superstation. So there's a variety of factors in these kind of sports investments, and just like we were talking about last week or 2 weeks ago, when you asked, well, how much do you have to pay a politician to get a benefit? And I said, it depends how aggressive you are, not specifically how much, although a bigger donation is better, but you can be very aggressive, very visionary, very entrepreneurial in politics as well. And it's the same thing here. If people don't have a bunch of plans that are going to work, then you're right, the investment doesn't make sense.
Well, how about commenting, both you guys, and I think you were listening earlier, regarding, you know, I don't really, if somebody's got that kind of money and wants to buy the Lakers, knock yourself out. This is America, right? But it always does, since, again, I used to do this, whenever you say, well, okay, we're going to buy this machine for our company, the first thing you're going to say is, well, the contracts that we currently have expire in 2 years. This is a 5-year machine. Do we think we have anything else coming down the road? These are kind of questions that you just normally ask, at least you used to ask. I don't know if you do anymore. But it seems to me we've been in this world, and, you know, I'll be trite here and say, you know, money for nothing and the chicks for free, where there's always money coming down the pipe every time the market starts to go down. People's view of the market, that's why I can ask these questions, are, you know, clients, people that are, you know, I don't know that many, but people that are 85 years old saying, I need all my money in the market. They're never going to let it go down. You know, that the market is a creature under itself, and no matter what happens to individual people and being able to buy stuff or how many people can afford a car or how many young people get laid off, or none of that matters. And you know what? I have not done as well as a manager. We've done fine, and I've done a lot of good stuff for people. But if I would have realized this 20 years ago, God, there'd been no stopping me. That no matter what happened, that you could have a COVID, you could have a depression, and at the end of the day, the market's going to be higher than when you start. This insane Iran war, and it may turn out okay, but in fact, this insane war, oil prices, people hurting in some areas. We got people in the Abraham Lincoln that the toilets don't work. Yet the market's
terrible.
The market's higher than when we started the thing. That is the backdrop of the investors for the last 20, 25 years. Now, it hasn't invaded my head that much because I've been doing it for 40 years. But you know what? I'd be so much wealthier if I just would have ignored my first 20 years.
Well, except that you and your clients have avoided the unpredictable disaster.
Correct.
So everybody should pat themselves on the back for that, because, you know, you think things can't get worse, they can. And hindsight is perfect, but so also is realizing that, you know, disasters can happen. I mean, in your last segment, you were talking about natural disasters. Well, there could be some in the financial markets.
But when does
don't see coming?
But when we've seen this for a long time, and we'll say when you talk, I mean, this progression where valuations of stuff have absolutely outperformed people's regular work, and that's happened from time to time. Okay, it's not like it's never happened, but sometimes they've come back. Sometimes violently. In 1929, it came back to Papa. Okay, that the people who were outstripping everybody else had a bad day. You don't want that to happen, and yet it seems like we're kind of right down that road. I mean, how many people? God, you know, just in the stuff that, you know, Audrey and Nancy, they come in and talk about on Monday, the people that are paying $500,000-$600,000 cash for a house, they never made that money. I mean, they never earned it. Well, obviously, earn it if you have an investment, but, you know, this is what the people's view of the world is going forward. I don't know that's. I guess to be blunt, I wish I could trade the last 10 years, but I can't. I got to trade the next 10 years, and what are they going to look like is the question. And that's what I'm asking you guys.
And then there's the situation with Main Street. I'm seeing stories about people having to sell coin collections, for example, so they can afford their prescriptions. Selling other things. The question is, the White House people are always saying, oh, the market's doing well. And then you hear these stories, and these are the stories that are starting to make the news, even in our corporate media environment. We're seeing these hard luck stories about how this economy is affecting people.
Well,
I think there's going to be a huge price the Republicans are going to pay in November, provided there's a fair election. And there's some question about whether that'll happen.
Well,
based on
think of it as yeah. Wait, I guess that is. You basically hit the nail on the head of my question. I'm asking is when is the tipping point? I mean, we know, I know, because people, we have clients, and I talk to people that are retired and so forth. I know a lot of people are retired. There are people that have 4 and 5 prescription drugs, even with the Medicare Part, was it D or E or what the hell it is?
Part D, and they're going to defund that, apparently, and announce it for next year, beginning 1 January.
But even
no
if,
more Part D.
But even if they leave it the way it is, you're still with the deductible in the front part and the hole in the middle. With, I can't know that hole. The hole. For those that don't know, yeah. it's really bizarre. With your first prescriptions, you pay. It's a big deductible you pay in the first quarter, and then they pay a bunch. But then there's a spot in the middle where you end up paying more again, and then if you go way over the top, then they pay more. But bottom line is you could be making you could be earning $25,000 a year in Social Security. You could easily be paying $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 for your prescription drugs, even with the insurance. Which maybe not quite that. So we're talking about 30% of your basket, and even though Biden and Trump before and all, but everybody's going to cut back these prescription drugs. Nobody's cut back on them at all.
No. Oh, you mentioned the tipping point, and I think it's kind of interesting as somebody who majored in history. The tipping point may be what's occurring, and you brought it up on the USS Abraham Lincoln. They deployed from San Diego in November. They were supposed to be back in May. It's now pushing into the middle of August. They not only are not getting needed supplies, packages from home, decent food, but there are now reports of mutinies on board. Reports that 7 sailors tried to jump overboard to commit suicide. Now, I remember what happened. It didn't happen with the Bolshevik Revolution, but there was years before that when they were starting to resistance in Russia was starting to stir against the Tsar. They had the issue with the battleship Potemkin, and it trained its guns on the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, and that actually launched. People thought, well, if the Navy's against the Tsar, so are we. And that was one of the first big attempted coups against the Tsar. I think if this is happening on the Lincoln, it's happening on other ships, too, that have been overextended in their deployment. And people in the Pentagon now refer to Hegseth as a major, because he was a major in the National Guard and got kicked out for his far-right political activities. But these are admirals and generals referring to the Secretary of Defense as...
Secretary of War.
As a major. You're calling him a major. That's like a slam dunk against him. That means he has absolutely no respect.
Well, you're a Navy dude, but Hal talks about being on a... I was just reading this last night because I was thinking about Hal, about the we got to go break here in a minute. We got to do a but he was talking about being on one of the. They built a few nuclear powered cruisers and destroyers. He was on a cruiser, I think, a nuclear, and he was one of the nuclear guys. I mean, wasn't one of the engineers, but he was the valve guy, making sure the damn thing was cooled off enough so it didn't blow up and stuff.
Right.
He said he was in the Persian Gulf. In number 1 or whatever, number 2, war against Iraq. I think he said, Jimmy, what did he say? 45 days. He didn't come up from downstairs of the thing. And it was the water was 93 degrees and the air conditioners didn't work. I mean, it's not the first time that we've kind of done this to people, but it wasn't November to August either.
Yeah. There were terrible deployments. Including on our nuclear submarines, something would go wrong. They got to remain in radio silence. So they couldn't even let their higher commands know, hey, we got a faulty this or faulty that, like a toilet or something, or garbage disposal. So yeah, this seems to be a willful type action by Hegseth and the group that's in charge of Pentagon.
I mean, I don't know anything. My whole experience in life is that the things that you don't expect always come up and bite you in the ass, basically. I mean, not always, but too often. And when we started shrinking down from this guy, this has been, we used to have you know what got me started on this, and then we got to go to break. There was I think it was a Time magazine article or Newsweek or something. I used to read those all the time when you actually read a whole article about stuff instead of just snippets. And this guy went on a cruise for an aircraft carrier. This is before Lincoln was even around, right? And in those days we had 20 carriers, or was it six? Whatever it was, we wanted four, we might have had 16, and we wanted four to be out at any given time. Okay, right. One in the Mediterranean, one in the Far East, whatever. And in order to do that, you needed 16, because if you're going to put somebody out for 6 months, which is about as long as you really want to, and he was on this one ship for 6 months, and he said the captain. And they were doing some stuff in Kosovo, wherever it was. They were bombing somebody. And he goes, the captain brought this ship back without a death, which is like means you're an admiral the second you get here, right? I mean, pull that off. But he said, in the last month or so, the captain was all over everybody because you start to get sloppy. And all it takes to get sloppy for a second, and all of a sudden the stuff doesn't work like it did when you went out, and you're trying to repair stuff at sea. But when you got back, he said the thing is totally taken apart. Every catapult, every elevator, it's shot, the boat. He said, and you basically rebuild the thing over the next 8 months. I mean, 2 weeks, 2 months after you come into port, the thing can't even go anywhere. The engines are all taken apart and everything. So then you get rid of that whole group of people. Then you bring on a whole new group of people. Then it's another 3-4 months where you're training everybody and the air wing comes in. And you're ready to go out for another 6 months. And that was the routine. But if you drop them 16 to 12, like they were planning on doing at the time, and you still want to keep the four out there, I mean, do the math. You're not going to be out there for 8 months or whatever. And he goes, that's a stretch. You know, it's a real stretch. I mean, unless you think it through, you don't think like that. And now we're down to what, 10? And now, and we're seeming like we're always at war. Guess what? We want four of them out there. You can't do it, or you can. But
we still don't know what happened with the USS Gerald Ford with the fire on board. It seems like the Pentagon's back into Vietnam days plus with not giving information. Of course, they banned the press corps too.
Yeah.
So we don't know what's going on in this.
But we're down to if we're gonna have active wars on. You need more than 10 aircraft carriers, right?
Sure.
I mean, duh. Anyway, SP Futures up 9, NASA Futures now down 20, so we're flipping and flopping here. We got the PPE we're going to talk about. I think we got that today. We're in initial jobless claims. When we're done with break, we'll go through that stuff. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. We've talked a lot on the show about risk and suitability, about how your portfolio should match your age, income, and risk appetite. It's been hard for investors to maintain that suitability in the last several years due to a Fed strategy that has driven interest rates to virtually zero. You may have even heard that the Fed was trying to drive conservative investors to a riskier portfolio on purpose, for whatever reason. I'm sure you are aware of investors that took some increased risk, such as longer-term fixed income securities, and are now unhappy with that choice. PTI, we've always stressed total portfolio risk awareness and tried to minimize chasing returns in a tough environment. Well, now it looks like maybe interest rates are moving more towards historical levels. Everyone needs to be aware of what that continued movement might do to your portfolio, both good and bad. We also have a stock market that seems to have stalled, at least for the short term. I think it's time for everyone to take a serious look at their goals, their risks, and their portfolios. Do they match? If not, we can help. We have a signature protected index program. We have ways to hedge against interest risk. We can make that portfolio right for you again. Go to PTISecurities.com or call us right now. The market can change very rapidly. That's PTISecurities.com.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now. 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield. 800-388-4901.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
We're back.
Rolling roll fix, stocks and jocks. I'm coming out, Jimmy, on the board. S&P futures up 9, NASDAQ futures down 18. We've got PPI for final demand unchanged in July. Services advanced 0.2%, goods fall 0.7%. Some of that has to be energy, which I think is back up in the last couple of weeks, but the we still have for the year prices for final demand increased 4.7% for the 12 months ended in July. So we still got a pretty good lift up for the year, but we got a little bit of a pause this month. So I guess that's a good thing. We have individual stocks, nothing going crazy. Cisco had earnings; they're down $8, 115.40. Stock was trading like 122. We actually did a trade in here. Yeah, we should be all right here, but the thing traded, I think, 132 after the numbers came out. Now it's 115. Ouch. You don't want to be the guy who bought it at 132. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 106.4%, FTSE down 34.3%. Kick around up 8, call that flat. So kind of wobbly in Europe, but just kind of steady across the board, I guess. Nikkei up 784. It's 1.1%. Hang Seng down 43. Call that flat. Shanghai down 19.5%. So, again, kind of a mixed bag over there as well. Bonds down 2 basis points, 4.67 on the 10-year. So, still elevated, but it kind of stopped going up the last few days. We've got oil down $1.71, 81.56. We've got gold, which has been on a tear, down 25 today, 44.42. Silver down 60 cents, 65.09. Foreign exchange, this is the one we're trying to watch here. The Japanese yen is back up to 159.29. Again, or 160 is the number that we try and protect, that they try and protect. When it got to 163, we intervened, our Secretary of the Treasury, and drove it down to 157. Now it's back up to 159, so it's kind of creeping back. He claims he'll do it again if he has to. He may have to. Bitcoin up 259, 63,567. A lot of stuff there. Jimmy, what do you have for us, Trevi Weather Sports?
Well, it is the 13th of August. It is 7:36. Currently on the inbound Kennedy, we have 19 minutes. The inbound Eden, the inbound Eisenhower, 25. And the inbound Dan Ryan is 24 minutes. In weather today in Chicago, we are going to have a high of 80. Right now it's 72. We are supposed to have heavy rain and thunderstorms.
Hey guys, if you want any water, our river and streams here are all at record flows for this time of the year. And we're getting more rain today and tomorrow and Saturday. It's unreal.
Yeah, we need it down here in Florida. You're turning into a real tornado alley out there in Chicago.
It's I don't know if you remember living here, Andrew. It's happening in the middle of the day. It's like noon, where it gets dark as can be. This massive thing, everyone has this, every one of them is preceded by this huge gust of wind that knocks everything down. The amount of trees on people's houses and all over the damn place. The South Shore is only running four trains because there's trees all over the tracks. Route 30 yesterday between the trees and the stoplights out was like closed. This is crazy. It's every day. It's probably out of the last 14, Jimmy. How many days have been like that? Six? Five?
At least.
Yeah. It's like every other day. We get some massive storm in the middle of the day.
One agency I have not heard mentioned at all, either for Chicago or Indiana or Columbus, Ohio, the other places got hammered, is FEMA. So I wonder what people are thinking. Usually the president would declare a disaster and make areas eligible for federal aid. I've heard none of that.
Well, it has
to be. They don't want to do it.
Well, so far it's somewhat contained. It's individual trees on fences, trees on houses. I mean, it's not like there's a massive, you know, Mississippi River flood or anything. You know, I mean, the deep tunnel's somewhat working, although the one quarry's at 95% capacity. I mean, guys, go through some of the election stuff, will you? Because I was talking to a couple of guys last night, and they're saying, you know, they can just sense that a lot of the Republicans are sort of in trouble because of the war, because of the prices, and all kinds of other things. But you know, there's still a big. But if you go through the actual, we were talking about this last week. If you go through the individual races, it's really hard to flip 5, 6, 7 Senate seats when only like 34 of them are up. The numbers don't seem to match the feeling.
The best case scenario I saw for the Democrats with the Senate is that they could. And there's a couple of outliers, but where it would be tough. But they could, in a best case scenario, they could wind up with 57 seats to the Republicans having 43. Now we're talking.
That means they'd have to pick up like 11 seats out of 34.
They'd have to pick up places like Nebraska, where there's an independent running against Pete Ricketts, the incumbent. I think he made all his money from Ameritrade or something. But people are tired of people.
That's a family that owns the Cubs. The Ricketts, they own the Cubs.
Yeah, Democrats are not running a candidate in Nebraska.
It's an independent who would caucus with the Democrats.
Has it said that, Wayne?
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's a big issue.
He'd not be the only one.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll keep going.
The situation in South Carolina with Lindsey Graham dying and his sister going in his place. Now she's got a runoff with this Ralph Norman guy who's actually more right wing than she is. But that's left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth in South Carolina. They're like, hey, wait a minute. Don't we have a choice in this? Trump tells his sister, well, you get the seat. There's a pediatrician, a lady running as a Democrat, and very similar to the El Sayed and Amy Acton running for governor in Ohio. These are all medical professionals. These are doctors. And I think people have just about had it with the voodoo medicine coming out of RFK Jr., Trump, and a few others. So we could, you know, in South Carolina, for example, and it's after a contentious GOP battle. So there's a lot of people upset, not only at Lindsey Graham before he died, but especially with his sister. So there could be some surprises in places like South Carolina and a few other states. Here in Florida, we have one of the Vindman twins. Vindman was there were two Army officers working in the White House. Both are born in Ukraine. One made lieutenant colonel. I think they both made lieutenant colonel. Trump got rid of one of them, and then he got rid of the twin brother. But one of the Vindmans would essentially, if he wins against Ashley Moody, who's another one of these Republican attorneys general here in Florida, like Pam Bondi, really didn't do anything when she was AG. And then Trump said, well, with DeSantis's concurrence, pick her for the Senate seat. I think there's kind of a disgust with people like Trump and DeSantis and others picking picking senators.
But does that mean they're going to vote for a Democrat?
Yeah. Yeah. Here in Florida, we see that Vindman is really inching up and in some cases tying Moody. Florida would be a big surprise. And the guy running for governor here, along with his lieutenant governor pick, is the daughter of a very beloved former governor and senator, Bob Graham. David Jolly, former Republican congressman, is
Bob Graham wasn't the guy whose wife was on the Enron board. What Graham was that? That was Phil Graham.
Oh, right? That was Phil Graham. Phil Graham, spelled differently from Grant. That was the Graham Rudman guy. So there's a couple of even the Democrats think they may have a shot in Mississippi. Now, if all these things happen, it could be 56, 57, or 55.
These guys have rickets, this thing I'm looking at, a political report. They got rickets as a Republican in Nebraska.
Well, that's incorrect. Yeah.
Okay, so these guys have
Ricketts, he is a Republican. That's true. The guy running against him is a guy named Osborne.
Okay.
Who's an independent, but has indicated he would like Angus King from Maine caucus with the Democrats.
Well, these guys have solid 14 of the how many are being raised? There's 34 Democratic seats not up for election, 31 Republican seats not up for election. So that's 65 that aren't up, and then you've got 35 that are up because there must be some people that died or something, right? Well, they've got solid Republican 14. They got likely Republican 2. In that column, they got Marshall and Ricketts. And you're saying Ricketts isn't that. They got lean Republican. They got Iowa and Texas. And I think both of those guys might lose. But
Iowa, there's a guy named Turek who's was born with spina bifida, but he's been in a lot of Paralympics. He's a basketball player in a wheelchair, and he's quite good. And I've seen polls with him ahead of, another one of these Republican women will take the place of Joni Ernst. And then Tallarico in Texas, polls are showing him running 2-4% over Paxton.
Well, these guys got the toss-up ones is Alaska, Maine, Michigan, and Ohio.
Yeah. Ohio, of course, is Sherrod Brown, a former Democratic senator who's running against not the guy who defeated him, but the other Senate seat, named John Husted.
Let me weigh in with a small technical point. I think a lot of professionals in the campaign business, they don't think of changing people's votes and persuading them. It's more about turnout. So when you said, are Republicans going to vote for Democrats, I think the professionals in this field tend to think more, let's discourage the Republicans from even bothering to vote and encourage our non-voting simpatico people to vote, which is a lot easier than changing somebody's mind. And so some of the factors Wayne was describing, I think, tend to discourage voting from previous Republican voters, not necessarily change them to suddenly supporting Democrats.
Andrew, you, as usual, must be your Midwest roots. You lead me right into my next question. You look at what's going on, and then this is a two-part question, actually two separate questions. You look at this what went on in Wisconsin and how close it was and nail-biting and people on both sides going crazy. This is in the primaries, right, and this week. And yet you look at the vote totals, 25% of the people showed up. So I don't think you realize how cogent you are in what you just said.
Exactly.
I mean, it's you would think that, if the whole state's fighting on both the Republican and the Democratic side, and both of them are neck and neck, and everybody's spending a gazillion dollars on everything, this is the governor's race and the Senate race, I think. It was the governor's race for sure. You would think that people get off their dead ass and go vote, but it didn't happen. I mean, 25% isn't very much.
Well, both Wayne and I, we're chastising ourselves because we each stayed up very late into the morning to watch those results. And what happened was a almost miraculous and yet explainable come-from-behind victory by about 3,500 votes by Daniel Crowley from Milwaukee to beat Francesca Heng, who was a kind of ultra-left Democratic Socialist candidate who had been way ahead in the polls by double digits a week in advance. But there were about 1.3 million votes total on the Democratic side, I think. No, I'm getting my figures wrong. But it was significantly ahead what the Republican primary was, because basically the centrist or moderately left Democratic Party of Wisconsin said, we cannot let her win. She's going to lose the seat. And so they got somebody from Milwaukee, Daniel Crowley, who had dropped out of the race 5 weeks ago, to get back in the race, and he won by 3,500 votes. And it avoided not just a disaster for the Wisconsin Democrats, but a national disaster for the party, because if she had won, that would have enabled nationwide advertising against Democratic candidates in Florida, South Carolina, Texas. So you look at what you get with the Democrats. But now, thanks to just 3,500 votes or so, it looks like the Democrats are in pretty good shape there. Also, Michigan, because there were unity rallies, and that's part of the subtext here, is that the people out of power have much more incentive to, that they don't always take as Democrats, but much more incentive to say, look, we got to win, let's bury the hatchet. And meanwhile, there's kind of fratricide occurring on the people who are in power, the Republicans, because they've forgotten what it's like to be on the losing side. So they're going ahead with their rivalries and grievances.
Also, many Republicans have failed to, they've decided not to hold town hall meetings anymore because they don't want to face the wrath and the ire of their constituents. So this is playing into the view that a lot of people have, with the Republicans just don't care. Now, the guy that represents me here in Florida, he's a second-generation member of Congress. He and his father basically own a car dealership. Well, he's not running again because people here in this district have had it with him, and a lot of people here on Social Security. So when people are hearing that Elon Musk wants to get rid of it, there's the obvious negative reaction to that.
Well, I have a question for you two mavens regarding the one guy in Wisconsin is saying there must have been vote fraud because he was ahead by 9 points in the poll and then he lost or something. Was that the Republican guy? Somebody was. I don't know. Anybody
I think you're talking about Lumpy Lindell up in Minnesota.
Okay, Minnesota.
My pillow guy.
Yeah.
I don't think there were any polls that showed him ahead, but he was a Trump-endorsed. Everybody knows he's got the mustache, my pillow. And he lost in Minnesota despite a Trump endorsement. And just like he's always complaining about Democrats rigging elections with totally phony claims, Now he's claiming the Republicans rigged the primary, and that's why he lost. And he can't accept the fact that people don't like him.
Well,
or his pillows.
Back in when I was a Ute, did he say Ute? We did a semester of statistics, and we must have spent at least 2 months on polling, surveys, and things like that. And you know, it had to do with, you know, you can take a random survey of a million people with 300 people. If you did it exactly right and exactly random, which is impossible to do, how in this day's world when nobody really has a home phone and people really get pissed if you call them on their other phone and hang up, how exactly, it's a two-part question because Andrew's brought up the first one, how do you even poll somebody and how do you know who's a likely voter? I mean, I don't see how any of these polls could be anywhere close to being accurate. I mean, just in my experience or what I was taught, it's not saying these people are idiots and they don't know what they're doing. Obviously, they're making money and people are paying them to do stuff. But how do you identify a likely voter? That's what happened with the Brexit in Europe. They identified people that had voted the last couple of times, and the people who came out to vote hadn't seen in a decade, and they weren't likely voters. And all of a sudden, they overwhelmed the thing. Right? I mean, what you just said earlier about the people not voting. If they gave us the job today to do a poll, how the hell would we even do it?
Well, it's estimates, and there's a lot of wiggle room. That's why it's called a margin of error. And also, there's factors like who's paying for the poll. So the Gallup organization headquarters is just 2.5 blocks from me. It's a marble palace on 9th Street here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, when's the last time you, me, or Wayne paid for a Gallup poll? Somebody's paying for this stuff. And even though there's a lot of PhD experts and grunt interns involved, ultimately, the people that pay are going to want some influence on the outcome, aren't they?
Well, I mean, but take it, let's take all the influence out. We're going to change, Wayne's now going to be Wayne Gallup. Somebody calls him up and says, give me a poll on the Senate race in Illinois with Durbin. I don't know much of a race that is, but what are we going to do? We're not going to walk along, you know, Michigan Avenue like the Three Stooges with a notebook.
You're not going to make calls either.
Yeah, you're not going to make home calls.
No. A lot of people aren't going to answer. I get calls, and I say I don't give my opinion on the phone. The odd thing is I'm giving my opinions here on the radio, but the I'm thinking, why do I want some stranger to know my thinking? By the way, this doesn't make any sense because, like I say, I'm giving my opinions here. But why should I take 5 minutes out of my life to give some stranger who might be some enemy of mine or my views trying to catalog stuff about me? It's just not worth it.
So that's my point.
Calls,
or I'll ask the question again.
Messages.
Or I'll ask the question again. How would we do it? I haven't the foggiest idea.
I'll
let Wayne go.
Well, you'd send out a lot of text messages. I think we've all get those.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's on to it's the mobile phone, so people, you know, are going to look at it. They may delete it, like I do, upon receipt. But you know, they figure if they send out so many, 500,000, 800,000 of these text messages, they're going to get some people to reply. Now, some of these are also campaign donation gimmicks where, well, if you reply, we got a button there, could you give $5 to us, you know? So but mostly it's done through these text messages. It used to be email, but they know people don't
but there's a difference between the people who have, don't take this personally, anybody, there's a difference between the people who are too busy to answer and the people who got nothing better to do. I mean you know, I remember them saying, this is in grad school, they said, if you're going to do a random survey and you're going to go up to Wayne's house, and Wayne's not home, you can't ask the guy ask the guy next door, because he might be unemployed and Wayne isn't, and now you're getting a different. I mean, you can't do that. You can't go down Michigan Avenue, because guess what? People on Michigan Avenue have enough money to shop in stores in Michigan or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's going to be random, you got to get that person. And I don't see how they come close to doing that.
Well, they don't. But they want to have the trappings of science. And there's another factor that does go into this bias in funding, and it's called a push-pull. And so they say, well, would you rather have a kind of handsome, accomplished candidate X, or someone who just stumbled into things candidate Y? Now, that's an extreme exaggeration, but you can think that...
Do you want Wayne, or do you want this schlump?
Yeah, right.
You get both.
Well, we know the answer.
Hey, are you guys going to get picked for Pirro's grand jury? What is this grand jury for?
Well, I just read a column early this morning on it by Joyce Vance, and former prosecutor, law professor in Alabama, and she was very careful not to say what the grand jury was. She gave the history of the law, what a special grand jury is, which is focused on one fairly complex matter under federal law. But I thought it was interesting that even though the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Jeanine Pirro, the former Fox News host, called it immediately after her job was put at risk by President Trump in the reflecting pool disaster where she had to dismiss the case. People assume it's because of that, but it may be for other purposes, probably nefarious, like getting indictments in prison for Dr. Fauci. That might be a more complex matter. I'm not sure we know what it's for. It's secret by law, so nobody's supposed to talk about it. But the witnesses are allowed to talk, not the grand jurors or the prosecutors. So once they start calling people in, then we'll have a better idea whether it's to re-indict this former Olympic athlete who stuck his hand into the reflecting pool, or whether it's more complex matters.
I'm gonna be snarky here, which I shouldn't be, but is there any connection between Carolyn Leavitt quitting and her being left on the plane they thought was at risk?
Well, funny you should mention that. We don't know. She certainly didn't say it, but we're at the end of the hour. But in some sense, your question may get to the most important story in America right now, because, you know, let me amplify just for a second here on this. It almost seems like a trivial matter for comedy or seriousness, but when you think about the implications of Trump sneaking off the plane with his two trusted aides
in a catering truck
and leaving cabinet members and the press vulnerable to being blown up by an Iranian attack, what are the implications of that for the country, for the midterm elections, or for somebody like Carolyn Leavitt, who might think, gee, I could have been on the plane. Would I have been given the warning to leave, or would I have been left on
the
plane?
Yeah, she's got two or three kids, for God's sake.
Yeah, and now there's questions about the veracity of the intelligence report. They said it came from Israel, which was probably Netanyahu, and I think many people in the intelligence community, at least in D.C., know not to believe everything that comes out of them. There's always an ulterior motive.
But just in terms of information, and we got a dash here, you would think that if the people were left on the plane, if you're one of these people, that the news story ought to be, the president came back on a military jet because he was needed in Washington. The rest of the people, because there were the rumor was that there was a cell in Turkey with some handheld rackets, the rest of the story should be that the plane took off with everybody else, flew a totally different direction, got here 12 hours late just to be safe, and we didn't want the president to be 12 hours late. If you had any common sense, that's the way you would do it. You wouldn't have those people fly over the same area where they thought there was the problem,
right,
would you?
Right.
God bless. How could you even think of that?
Or keep them in Ankara for an extra night, you know, and fly out.
I mean, good. I could see her getting home and her husband going, hey, wait a minute, Mom.
This is a story that may not die, even though all of the people on the plane, the somewhat beholden press corps and the cabinet secretaries and the pilots will lose their job if they dig into it in the same way that we're talking about it now. They will be fired if they ask these obvious questions that we're talking about now.
But Senator Schiff said that she's leaving to spend more time with the truth.
Oh, God. SP Futures up 18. NASDAQ Futures up 52 again. PPI came in a little light, as did the CPI yesterday. So that's pretty good news, guys. Thank you. Talk at you next week, if not before. Jimmy, good job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.